This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, March 21st, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry today. We thank you so much for being with us. And you know, for all the presidential nominations and all the controversy, Betsy DeVos, Rex Tillerson, Ben Carson, none of those President Donald Trump picks is as big as Neil Gorsuch.
My decisions have never reflected a judgment about the people before me. I'm acutely aware of my own imperfections. The answers we reach are always the ones we believe the law requires.
Of course, that is Neil Gorsuch, and he is President Donald Trump's pick to join the Supreme Court. And today, he's in his second day of confirmation hearings in the Senate. Judiciary Chairman Senator Chuck Grassley, the Republican, was first out of the gate with questions for Neil Gorsuch this morning. It was on judicial independence. And on this line of questioning, Neil Gorsuch has remained firm today.
I have offered no promises on how I'd rule in any case to anyone. And I don't think it's appropriate for a judge to do so, no matter who's doing the asking.
As for the Democrats here, a major theme is President Obama's pick for the same role, Merrick Garland. Now, Republicans never even gave Garland a hearing in the Senate, much less a vote. And we're going to talk about that with a former Democratic member of the Judiciary Committee in just a few minutes. But the judge also faces tough questioning on his record, his rulings, and opinions on such lightning rod cases as Roe v. Wade. Here he is in an exchange with Senator Dianne Feinstein of California.
Do you view Roe as having super precedent?
Well, Senator, super precedent is a
in numbers, 44.
It has been reaffirmed many times. I can say that. Yes.
Yes, dozens. Yeah.
Here's Gorsuch again with Chuck Grassley.
Can you tell me whether Roe was decided correctly?
Senator, again, I would tell you that Roe versus Wade, decided in 1973, is a precedent in the United States Supreme Court.
The rulings and record of Neil Gorsuch are at stake. Joining me now is Tim Meyer. He's a professor of law and an enterprise scholar at Vanderbilt Law School. He clerked for Judge Gorsuch on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit from 2007 till 2008. Welcome to The Takeaway, Tim.
Hi, Todd.
So you clerked for Neil Gorsuch. You know his rulings well. What aspects of his judicial temperament, his experience, his rulings, do you think make him suitable for the high court for the rest of his life?
He's got a couple of features that I think are going to make him, should he be confirmed, a really great justice. The first is that he is a phenomenal writer. Much like Justice Scalia, you know, writing, the written word, is the medium through which judges communicate not only with lawyers, but ultimately when you're making these important constitutional rulings with the American people. And Judge Gorsuch has a way of reducing complicated legal issues, I think, to analogies and phrases that you and I and people who are not trained in the law can understand.
Let's just talk about a couple of big cases that Judge Gorsuch ruled on. People may have heard of them, and they're probably going to come up. They will be coming up as the Senate evaluates him. One is Hobby Lobby, the big case that was one of the early test cases of the Affordable Care Act in the Supreme Court. It's famous now and will continue to be as they debate Obamacare. Now, Judge Gorsuch said in that case that religion is a moral guide for some people to make decisions about what they want to support. And of course, at the heart of this was a corporation, Hobby Lobby, that didn't want to be forced to cover contraception for women who had insurance under the Affordable Care Act. That's how Judge Gorsuch ruled, that there was a moral component here. You know, and slippery slope arguments have lots of opportunities in judicial rulings, but a lot of people would have heard that and said, yeah, I agree. I don't want my money going to the Iraq war, for instance, because that's morally dubious, right?
Well, you know, the difference there is that both in the First Amendment, the Free Exercise Clause, and then in a statute that actually was passed in 1993, the Religious Freedom and Restoration Act, religious beliefs and the free exercise of religious beliefs has been something that the founders and then the Democratic Congress and President Clinton, when he signed the Religious Freedom and Restoration Act, have said, you know, look, when you're interpreting other statutes, we need to make sure that we don't burden the free exercise of religion. And part of what Judge Gorsuch said in that is that once we decide that somebody has a sincere religious belief, it's not for the court to evaluate the reasonableness of that belief, that religion is a moral guide to people and that their right to be guided by their religious beliefs is what's protected.
Let's move on to another important case. It goes by the shorthand of Chevron, which basically said here that if the meaning of a law, the wording of a law, is ambiguous, that everybody should just defer to the relevant regulatory agency. I don't know, the SEC or the Interior Department, if you like. Conservatives do not like this interpretation, and Neil Gorsuch is with them.
Judge Gorsuch wrote a concurring opinion 2 years ago that called into question the foundation of what's called Chevron deference, the idea of deferring to administrative agencies when they interpret ambiguous statutes. And his basic belief is that it's the duty of the courts to say what the law is. And one of the things you'll hear, as you just indicated, is that that has a particular political valence. But I don't think that's true. I think one of the things that we'll see is that, of course, any administration can implement a regulation through an administrative action. And the question is the court going to defer to that agency? And so how you the sort of political valence of that depends entirely on who the president is and who the relevant agency is.
Tim Meyer, we're about to talk to Senator Russ Feingold, former Senator Russ Feingold from Wisconsin, who, of course, was on the Judiciary Committee for many, many years. He is one of the voices among many who says it's not even really about Neil Gorsuch at this point. The treatment of Merrick Garland by the Republican Senate, never even providing a hearing, was so egregious that it's threatened the integrity of the court itself and of the Senate. As you watch the confirmation process from the outside, maybe you separate yourself from someone who I know you respect very much, Neil Gorsuch. Is there any merit to that argument for you?
So I've had the chance to meet Judge Garland. Judge Garland is a wonderful man. He's a wonderful public servant, and he's a wonderful jurist. And I think he would have made an excellent Supreme Court justice. And so, to those who say, that they wish that Judge Garland was on the court, I'm sympathetic. I think he would have been a great justice. We don't find ourselves in that situation now. And in the hearings today, of course, there's very little Judge Gorsuch can say about that. This was mentioned yesterday, but one of the things that sort of most impresses me about Judge Gorsuch is that one of his first calls after he was nominated was to Judge Garland, because the two of them have a relationship that goes back years. And I think there's a lot of mutual respect there.
You know, Tim Meyer, one of the features of this phenomenon, of course, is the president. President Trump has attacked judges, federal judges, based on their ethnicity. He's accused them of being political activists against him when he doesn't like their rulings. Democrats in the Senate seem to have laid out kind of a clear path for Neil Gorsuch here, that if he can repudiate these kinds of attacks and this politicization of the judiciary on part of the man who nominated him, that some of them may be willing to vote for him. Is that something he – certainly it's something he can do. Is it something he needs to do very strongly here?
This actually goes back to your question about Chevron deference. Ultimately, what that is, his view that he staked out there, is the idea that it is the job of the judiciary, of courts, to say independently of the executive branch what the law is. And in a lot of ways, that's one of his key issues. So I don't think he's going to have too much trouble getting the message across that that he's going to be an independent judge or justice on the Supreme Court.
Tim Meyer, professor of law and enterprise at Vanderbilt, who clerked for Neil Gorsuch from 2007 until 2008. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well, the big names of the Senate Judiciary Committee, like Orrin Hatch, Dianne Feinstein, Lindsey Graham, who you heard from, even Al Franken, will drill down on Judge Neil Gorsuch today. Former Wisconsin Democratic Senator Russ Feingold sat on that very Judiciary Committee for 16 years and cast votes on 6 of the 8 current Supreme Court justices. But Russ Feingold says that Neil Gorsuch should be filibustered and defeated by Democrats and Republicans, and that the integrity of the court and the Senate is at stake. Senator Russ Feingold, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be on the show. Thank you.
And so I just described it. You've said that confirming Neil Gorsuch would endorse and normalize unconstitutional political games. You're talking about Merrick Garland.
Well, I'm actually talking about the scam that's going on here. I listened to your previous guest, and he talked about, Merrick Garland is a good guy, and I can certainly say that Judge Gorsuch is a distinguished person. That's not the issue. It's not these individuals. The question is this a legitimate process when it is not really legitimately the nomination of Donald Trump and even of this Senate to consider it? That was Barack Obama's nomination. So this is a violation of the Constitution. It is a devastating attack to the credibility of the United States Supreme Court. So the scam is to sort of just concentrate on the individual and forget the crime that's been committed here against our system of government and against the legitimacy of our system of government. The way I like to think of it is let's say somebody claims to have title to a house and they sell it to Judge Gorsuch. And people say, well, wait a minute, you didn't have good title. He said, well, wait a minute. The judge is a great neighbor. He's a good family man. He mows the lawn. He shovels the snow. He's even a gardener. That's not the question. Neil Gorsuch does not have good title to this seat because it was stolen by the Republicans in the last Congress. And that is the bottom line.
Of course, that one of the risks of the type of opposition, Senator Feingold, that you're talking about here, good title or no, is one of escalation. I mean, you know far better than I that every senator will make a judgment here about whether they want to just take the hit that Merrick Garland sort of delivered to the process here or escalate. And you say escalate.
Well, look what's happened. Prior to this, they already escalated it to the nth degree. When a vacancy occurred that President Obama should have been able to fill with somebody like Merrick Garland, they escalated it as far as you basically possibly can, completely denying the seat being filled. And that's going to impact overwhelmingly what the ideological and other aspects of the Supreme Court are. And so, in fact, they've already taken it that far. If anybody on the Judiciary Committee in the Senate believes that the Republicans will act differently next time there's a vacancy, that somehow they'll say, oh, that's okay that you're opposed this time, we'll get somebody else. No, if you let them do this, they will do exactly what they're doing on everything else. And by the way, this attack on the Supreme Court is only one of several attacks on the legitimacy of our system of government that has been going on for many years prior to Donald Trump. One is the attack on the right to vote. Another is the Citizens United decision, which devastated our campaign finance system. Another is the ridiculous way in which the Electoral College has been able to elect a president two out of the last three times. He didn't even get a majority of the votes. And the other is this one, the damage to the Supreme Court. So what I'm concerned about here is that the real issue here is the right and the corporate powers in this country are gutting the basic institutions of our country, gutting the legitimacy of our system of government. And this hearing today is an aspect of that attack.
And you think, it seems, Senator Feingold, that your fellow Democrats might not be drawing a sharp sword as they could be here?
Well, I'm not in any position to criticize these individuals, many of them my former colleagues for whom I have a lot of respect. All I can say is if anybody believes that the Republicans who got away with this scam are going to learn the lesson, if they're allowed to do this again, that they shouldn't do it again, there's no way. They'll do it every time. This is an illegitimate stealing of a seat on the Supreme Court that controls the balance of the court.
What did you make of the first day of intros and speeches in the Judiciary Committee? You have a Neil Gorsuch, who, of course, is in front of the committee now, defending his independence. All judges have to do that, but he's been nominated by a president who's made a particular show out of attacking federal judges based on their ethnicity, saying that they're politically motivated against him if he loses a case. Seems like Neil Gorsuch is in a real position here where he has to say, I'm going to defend the integrity of the branch of government here.
Well, I certainly hope he does, because he is a person who's had a distinguished career, who really is committed to the judiciary. He's got to feel a little funny about accepting this nomination from somebody who has such total disregard for the independence of the judiciary and is so cynical about it, not to mention that the seat itself is not legitimate for the reasons I've already mentioned. It must feel bad for him to have to get on the Supreme Court this way when he knows very well this should have been Judge Garland's seat. And so I'm hoping that if he ends up being confirmed, which of course I don't think should happen, that he will be somebody who will stand up for the court and stand up to the president. And that is critical, but it doesn't change the fact that what's been done here is much more serious than whether or not Judge Gorsuch will rule in a particular way in a case.
You know, it's hard to look at the strategy that Republicans deployed against Merrick Garland, Senator, and not just have the cold calculation that it's worked. I mean, Mitch McConnell took a lot of heat from people for not giving Garland even a hearing. But here's Mitch McConnell, who looks like he may give Donald Trump one more nominee on the Supreme Court. What lesson do you think Mitch McConnell's taking here from this game that's gone on for more than the last year?
Well, that's the problem. When you have people in public life who've sworn to uphold the Constitution and their test is, did it work or didn't it work, we're in a sad state. It worked all right. They're going to get the majority in the court that they don't deserve. And they're going to create a cycle where Democrats will have a horrible choice to make in the future. Are they just going to be chumps and make sure that whenever there's an opening on the Democratic side that the Democrats play fair? Or are they going to do the same thing that the Republicans have done? The end of this will be devastating the credibility of the United States Supreme Court, which remains the ultimate arbiter of the law in our country and one of the only bulwarks for security and unity within this country. Doing that is unforgivable. And so I really have a problem with members of the Senate or people in politics for whom the only test is, did it work? Did we win? There's more than winning that's involved. It's protecting this great country. And the damage to the Supreme Court could be permanent if somehow we don't step back from the brink here and allow this seat to be filled that is not supposed to be filled by this president.
If senators follow your advice, Russ Feingold, and mount a credible filibuster here, of course, one of the possible outcomes is the nuclear option, an evisceration of the requirement for 60 votes, consensus votes for a Supreme Court nominee. That's an eventuality, as you know, that many of your colleagues say would damage the Senate even more deeply than this entire Merrick Garland episode.
Well, I disagree with that because they're going to go ahead and threaten this every time to get to, in effect, create no requirement of 60 votes. That's what they're doing here. It's effectively the same. It's much more serious that they were unwilling to allow a president to have his nominee considered. They're going to get their way every time. And so if that's the way it's going to be, what is the point of preserving a filibuster that you can't even use? It doesn't really make any difference in the long run. And again, this is something that we have to stand up to. You have to stand up. Now, and there are ways to solve this. In other words, it's not a question of saying, let's just have eight justices. I understand that there was at least a report that Senator Tom Udall of New Mexico said, well, can't we have some kind of an agreement that if you put Gorsuch on the court, that the next vacancy would go to Merrick Garland, for example. Some kind of a reparation, some kind of an acknowledgement that what was done here was a crime against the Constitution to make this whole again. That's what we need. And that's why a filibuster here, stopping this nominee for now, until that kind of a good agreement can be made, would be a positive step forward that would avoid this great damage to the Supreme Court and to our system of government and to the legitimacy of our government.
Well, in about the minute we have left, Senator Feingold, just help me get inside the minds of some of your fellow Democrats real quickly, just for a minute. It seems to me that Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader, a couple of weeks ago really laid out a path, perhaps, for Neil Gorsuch to get confirmed. He said he has to establish this independence that we talked about from Donald Trump because Donald Trump attacks judges, and that might be a way for a lot of red state Democrats, Democrats in states that Donald Trump won, to justify a vote for him in the end.
I understand that, and I respect Chuck Schumer. He's a good friend, and I realize he has a particular responsibility as the minority leader. But I'm looking at this from a different perspective, which is the history and the future of the United States Supreme Court, the legitimacy of our system of government. And frankly, for me, that overrides that. But I, of course, have great regard for each of the senators that will be acting on this.
Well, the fight is on, and one of the questions is how hard will Democrats or even one or two Republicans fight against the nomination of Neil Gorsuch to join the Supreme Court, all because of Republican treatment of Merrick Garland? Russ Feingold is a former senator from Wisconsin, a member of the Judiciary Committee, and one senator who says Republicans and Democrats should join together and defeat this nominee. Senator, we thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and Republicans' longstanding promise to repeal the Affordable Care Act and replacement has hit some snags as conservatives and moderates in the Republican Party balk at many of the policies in their leadership's bill. President Trump is on Capitol Hill today trying to rally Republicans around the proposal, which he says might be the only chance to repeal and replace Obamacare. It's the ultimate sales job for the marketer in chief on Capitol Hill, as Republicans across the spectrum say they might not want to vote for this proposal. Over the past few months, we've been hearing from people who get their insurance through the Affordable Care Act and are watching this repeal process very closely. Today, we hear from someone who says she's worried.
My name is Fraser Speaks. I'm 27 years old, and I live in Charleston, South Carolina. I'm on ACA because I switched careers recently and decided to go back to graduate school, and I needed some sort of insurance. And ACA was the only thing that was available to me. I need insurance, most importantly, for mental health. I am diagnosed with major depressive disorder and type 2 bipolar. Care and treatment for mental illness is not cheap. And so if I was having to pay everything completely out of pocket, I don't think I would be able to afford it. And this is a life-saving thing that I need, you know, kind of a life or death situation. While I was switching careers, I didn't have insurance for a couple of months, and I actually had to be hospitalized again for that because during that time, I wasn't able to afford to go to all my therapy appointments, and my situation at the time just got pretty much out of control. And so I had to be hospitalized. Now I'm paying for that, and it's very, very pricey. So that adds a lot more stress to what I'm dealing with. You know, how am I going to afford to pay this off and the amount of time I'm going to have to spend paying it off? The ACA is affordable for me based on my income. I pay about $100 a month, which I could choose to pay a lower premium, but the one I chose was based on what I need and what I can afford. So a time that I was very, very glad I had it is actually more of just kind of a every other week thing where I go to therapy. And so if I was paying out of pocket for that, it would be about $100 a visit. But right now I'm paying $20 a visit, which is way more affordable and just easier to get by than paying $100 because I can't afford to spend $100 every other week on something that I actually really need. So that could be kind of life-threatening, or I could end up back in the hospital without having the proper care that I need. My conditions are considered pre-existing conditions, which is another thing that makes me thankful that I have ACA because it covers pre-existing conditions. I have been following the repeal process, and honestly, it's pretty frightening. They admitted that, yes, this would affect mental health coverage. This makes me feel very frightened. I'm worried about myself if an insurance plan I decide to go on does not have to cover that, then how am I going to afford my treatment? And it's just kind of a scary situation because it's very unsure and unclear if it's actually going to go through and then how exactly it will end up affecting me.
That was Fraser Speaks from Charleston, South Carolina. She's in graduate school to become a guidance counselor, and she says she relies on the insurance in the Affordable Care Act to cover treatment for mental health conditions. You're hearing sounds from the battle in Mosul in northern Iraq. Let's stay with the fight against the Islamic State now. Government and Iraqi coalition forces continue to battle ISIS outside of Mosul. That fight has now moved to one of the most densely populated parts of the city. According to Iraq's immigration ministry, more than 350,000 Iraqis have been displaced from the city center since that campaign began. Residents, in a lot of cases, are making a stark decision to stay and risk food shortages and shelling, or try to leave after ISIS has threatened to kill anyone who tries to exit the city. Tens of thousands have turned to refugee camps, meanwhile, springing up all over the area, and aid workers are scrambling to keep up with the influx. Caroline Gluck is Senior Information Officer for the United Nations Refugee Agency in Iraq. She's been visiting those camps. Caroline, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, we understand that refugees have been pouring into these camps. What does the scene now look like, and how are the people doing there?
It varies between camp to camp, but yesterday I was in Hammam al-Alil, and this is the area where most of the displaced families are having to go through as a transit site. So they will have fled their areas, been taken by the Iraqi security forces via different routes to Hammam al-Alil, where they are security screened. And because that camp, which is currently a government camp, is full, families are then taken by buses to other sites that have capacity. When I visited, the conditions were very grim. It had been raining quite heavily. The whole camp was very, very muddy. Families were caked in mud. Many families had lost their shoes in the flight to safety, especially young children, and were walking barefoot through the mud in very difficult conditions. While the men were being security screened, the families, the women and the children were having to wait outside in an open area. It was cold, it was wet, and it was pretty grim.
So with more than 350,000 people displaced, is this combination of Iraqi government camps and UN camps able to handle the capacity right now?
At the moment, yes, there is spare capacity. For example, UNHCR has 10 camps that are currently open, and we have capacity for about 24,000 individuals. We have two other camps that will be open within days, and again, they will have capacity for another 9,000 to 10,000, with another 20,000 capacity coming on stream in the current weeks. The scale of displacement has really quickened in the last month, because the western sector of Mosul is the most populous, it's the most densely populated. And now the Iraqi security forces have entered the old city, which is where the greatest numbers of people are. And we are very concerned about the numbers who are still there. We estimate around 600,000 civilians could still be in those western sections, and maybe around half of that figure could still be displaced in the coming days and weeks.
Yes, you raise a very important point, which is, as grim as some of the situations are for hundreds of thousands fleeing Mosul, there are hundreds of thousands still left there, and we're talking about urban warfare where ISIS fighters have really metastasized into the city over the last several many years, and now the fight is on to root them out.
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult for families. I mean, I've been listening to some of the stories of people who have left. We're hearing that all the street markets have closed and that very few shops are open. The shops that are open have very little for sale, and the goods that are for sale are astronomical in price, beyond the reach of many people. So families are really surviving on very little. They told us they were eating water and flour, maybe supplemented with some tomato paste, and many families were just eating one meal a day. They were getting increasingly desperate. There's also a big problem with lack of fuel. Families have been burning furniture, pieces of rags, plastic to stay warm. And the fuel has also meant that there's very little electricity through the generators. So life in general has got exceedingly grim. And the hunger issue is one of the main factors that has been prompting families to leave, as has, of course, the worsening security situation.
And Caroline Gluck, as you talk to people, do you have a sense from them, as bad as these stories are, that this could be the beginning of the end for ISIS in their neighborhoods? The hunger is grim. The burning of furniture is very difficult to listen to. And I wonder if the people going through this have some sense that this may be a final chapter for them, and maybe they can finally live at home in Mosul in some peace and quiet.
Absolutely. I mean, that is definitely the hope of all the families that I've been speaking to. There are some who don't want to go back, but the majority, I would say, are very keen to return home, but only when there is peace, when they know that they can go back safely. They want to rebuild their lives. They want to go back home to secure their property. They want their children to go back to school.
There have also been threats from ISIS itself within Mosul, threats on the lives of civilians who leave. I imagine that's complicating the picture a lot for people trying to decide between taking the risk of leaving Mosul and seeking safety in a camp or somewhere outside the city.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I heard lots of stories from families. When they were leaving, they saw people killed by sniper fire. They risked being blown up by IEDs or landmines. One lady yesterday told me she came from a place called Al-Tanak neighborhood, that a large group of people, 30 people, had been hiding in a school intending to flee the city. They were informed upon by somebody in the community, and that they were all killed, that the bodies had been laid out as a warning to others who might be considering fleeing. And I asked her, well, you've decided to flee. Despite that, why did you make that choice? Her answer was, the risk of death is present. Whether you stay, you risk death through the fighting, through the mortars and the shelling. If you flee, you risk death through the escape and the chances of being caught. You know, it's a choice between two very difficult things. What do you choose? In the end, I chose to flee because there was also a prospect of starving to death as food was running out. So it was a very difficult decision for everybody involved.
Caroline Gluck is Senior Public Information Officer for the UN Refugee Agency in Iraq. Thank you for updating us.
Thank you so much.
President Trump hasn't yet made many overt foreign policy moves, but that appears to be changing now. Earlier this month, the commander-in-chief announced his decision to send 400 additional U.S. troops to Syria, including a team of Army Rangers and a military artillery unit. In addition to that, 2,500 ground troops to a base in Kuwait, within striking distance of targets in Iraq and Syria. In a few minutes, we're going to get a view of some of Iraq's refugee camps as coalition forces try to push ISIS out of Mosul. But first, a look at the Trump administration's latest moves in the region. Andrew de Grandpre is chief editor and Pentagon bureau chief for Military Times, and he joins me now. Andrew, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me.
I mentioned 400 additional troops to Syria, 2,500 ground troops to Kuwait. Is this a significant American escalation in the fight against ISIS?
Well, I would say it depends who you ask, certainly. But yeah, on the face of it, I mean, it's definitely a shift. The extra troops that you mentioned in Syria are doing two different missions. The Army Rangers are conducting what's called reassurance and deterrence. It's sort of a new term that the Pentagon has come up with, aimed at keeping two ethnic rivals kind of at bay from fighting one another in a city called Manbij. The other assets have been deployed in and around Raqqa, which is the Islamic State's self-declared capital. And they're primarily Marines, U.S. Marines, and they brought a lot of artillery with them.
The president during the campaign promised that he would get a plan to defeat ISIS within 30 days from his commanders. Is this the plan?
I would say that this is probably a component of the plan. I think that the president's goal is looking beyond just Iraq and Syria and how to defeat not only the Islamic State, but also terror groups that exist elsewhere in the world.
So many of the units involved here have been involved already in backing up Iraqi troops and assisting with logistics, with intel. This mission seems like it's different now.
Well, I think the Pentagon would say that by and large, it's going to remain the focus to do everything that the U.S. military can to support both the Iraqis and the sort of coalition of militia forces that have been assembled in Iraq. But if they're bringing more firepower in to those regions, clearly they want to step up the effort to get the Islamic State out of there.
And is there evidence that the fight has been wanting for this kind of increased U.S. combat capability? I mean, are there things the Iraqi coalition hasn't been able to do, and they're saying they need U.S. guns and U.S. troops to do it?
Well, Mosul in particular has been a tough slog. I spoke with a two-star army general in charge of land forces in Iraq not too long ago. And the picture he painted is that, you know, this is tough urban battle. I think, you know, they're going block by block, in some cases door by door, looking to get militants out of there. You know, having additional U.S. support in that mission is only going to speed things along, I think, in the mindset of most people both in the Pentagon and who are forward deployed in command positions in the war zone.
And, you know, Andrew, if we take a big step back from this, sort of from the foreign policy perspective, the strategy during the Obama years was getting the U.S. out of combat missions in Iraq and Afghanistan. They were popular moves by President Obama. Does this mean that that doctrine from the Obama administration is gone and overt use of U.S. troops against ISIS is back on the table in a way that significantly shifts our foreign policy posture here?
I wouldn't say significantly. Certainly, President Trump has been an outspoken critic of many of the decisions that his predecessor made. However, many of the generals and military and national security experts that have, you know, been solicited by the president for their advice do see some value in kind of the limited warfare, if you will, that President Obama advocated. So, you know, on the one hand, you can see the potential deployment of 2,500 troops to Kuwait as something of an alarming escalation. At the same time, you know, that if a percentage of those do end up going into the war zone, you're still looking at a significantly smaller footprint overall compared to the height of the Iraq war.
Andrew de Grandpre, chief editor and Pentagon bureau chief for the Military Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, let's talk about happiness, your happiness, America. Yesterday on our Listener Response Network, we asked you to think about how happy you are and rate it on a scale from 1 to 10. 0 is not happy at all. Please don't be a 0. And 10 is being the very happiest you could possibly be. Come to think of it, definitely do not be a 10.
This is Damaris Morrill from St. Louis. Right now, my level of happiness is at a 10, but my normal range of happiness is from a 7 to 9. Have my health, money in the bank, a happy marriage, and 3 healthy kids, and I just paid off one of my student loans. If I was in the habit of using hashtags, hashtag winning would apply.
My name is Don. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Well, up until the election, I was about an 8, but after the election, I'm about a 3. I got a bit scared every night wondering what's going to happen overnight while I'm asleep.
Well, Don isn't the only American whose self-described happiness has been slipping lately. In fact, our national score, how happy we say we are, dipped more than a half a point since last year. That's all according to the World Happiness Report. It's released this week. Americans rate 6.993 on average, and that makes you, America, the 14th happiest country in the world, down a tick from 13th last year. Who's happier than you? Denmark is, and Iceland and Switzerland. Finland joins them in the top 5. And coming in at the number one happiest place on Earth, Norway, which produces cheerful pieces of sunshine like this. Yes, Norway prides itself on being one of the world's top exporters of death metal. And this is a great time to bring in John Helliwell. He's a senior fellow at the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research and editor of the 2017 World Happiness Report. Hi, John.
How are you?
I'm happy. Not what you'd expect from the happiest place on Earth, Norway. Then again, maybe they can just afford it. They're so happy they can afford all that death metal.
Everybody's got varied tastes.
Well, what do you make of it? I mean, Norway number one on the list. That's their music. But how are you measuring this? What makes Norway so very happy and what makes America so very middling?
Two questions there. How do we measure it? 1,000 people are asked in every country every year by the Gallup World Poll to think of their lives as a ladder with the best possible life as a 10 and the worst as a 0. And those answers are averaged, and in the reports, we average them over 3 years to give us a big sample so they don't jump around too much. However, in the absolute top section of the Premier League, the top 4 countries are very close, and so you'll find one team winning one time and another winning another time, and that's what's happened with Norway, first time in first position, but it's been in that Premier group for a long time.
So, John Helliwell, you're asking a very straightforward question. I mean, it couldn't be more straightforward. Rate your own happiness 0 to 10. But then it's really the picture behind that that's important, right? What's going on at home or in society that's making people feel that way?
And that's the tough part in a way. It's non-controversial just to collect scores and report them. And that's why we do the rankings that way. But in some ways, the fun part is then doing the research and trying to explain what makes people happier in the happiest countries and less happy in the unhappy countries. And we've come up with 6 variables that dip into different aspects of life. They're not the ideal variables, but they're best we can do from the data we have, and they include income and good health. And of course, the top countries are always leaders in that. In fact, the top countries are leaders in all 6 of them. And the next are somebody to count on in times of trouble, a sense of freedom to make your key life decisions, living in a generous country measured by donations, and freedom from perceived corruption in government and business.
And, you know, then you're faced with the inevitable scientific question, John, it seems to me, which is, do those conditions cause happiness, or do happy people make better conditions for themselves?
Oh, it's a nice question. And the answer is we know quite a lot more from the last 30 years of research. It's a positive feedback of just the sort you described. So you get on the right side of the line, then these high trust gives you more connections give you higher trust, and each of them gives you an extra boost of happiness on the way. And when you're happier, you're more inclined to reach out towards other people and pick up their lost wallets.
So that's sort of happiness on the population basis, which is what you're studying. And I wonder if it's given you any insight into individuals. I mean, it's one thing for 1,000 people to sort of aggregate around, you know, 7.5, which is nice. Do we know much about what makes an individual, say, whether they're a 9 or a 4?
A fair amount, because, of course, we have millions of responses to these surveys now, and the answers run from 0 to 10. And so we can figure out quite a lot about what's going on in individuals' lives. And the 6 factors I mentioned are all part of the story, but the dominant part, as we emphasize in the report this year, is the social foundations of life, the extent to which people feel they're in a trusting, caring environment where they're connected to other people and feel that they're part of a community.
So, John Halliwell, you're Canadian. This American needs you for a little bit of cross-border therapy here. I mean, you're in charge of this study. And here in America, we've slipped a little bit from 13th to 14th, right?
It's a slight decline, but there is a tendency that's picked up in Chapter 7 of the report that there's a bit of a downward trend over the last few years, fueled by drops in those social factors.
So as the researcher, as the guy who does this report, I know that you probably watched a fair amount of our campaign. What did you say to yourself in your living room watching TV when you saw a campaign commercial saying, we're going to make America great again? It's not great anymore.
Part of the secret to my happiness is I don't spend a lot of time watching television.
And
part of the reason for that is that systematically, and we've got proof of this in a variety of ways, the news coverage tends to focus on the negative aspects of life and not a balanced view, so that the more you watch the news, the more jaded you get or skeptical you get about the warmth of the social context in which you're living. In a global sense, there's been this divisive move in several countries, so it's not unique to the United States, and we see evidence of it elsewhere as well.
So I guess the question is your report best for individuals, for us, the action in our lives, or do you want to sit down with President Trump and Angela Merkel and Theresa May and give them this report and tell them what's happening with happiness in their countries?
It's both. We're trying to get, in general, how people feel about their lives to be treated more seriously than national income or unemployment rates or any of the usual things that leaders talk about and people talk about. And to do that, we have to raise the profile in the public, and then we have to make sure that the science is good enough to support serious discussions with policymakers about how they might set a stage within which happier lives are going to be lived.
And part of the beauty of the World Happiness Report is that while you're reading it, you can turn off the television. Maybe the most important advice from John Halliwell. He's senior fellow at the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research and editor of the 2017 World Happiness Report. John Halliwell, have a happy day.
Same to you.
This is Tiffany from Lehi, Utah. We rank about an 8 in happiness. Yes, we have debt, but my children are happy. They're healthy. My husband has a great job. We live in a safe area. We're just loving everything we can do. Things could be better, but they're not worse.
And on our question of happiness, we got this from a listener in Monroe, Louisiana. Happiness is more a state of mind than a magnitude. It can't be measured. It can only be pursued. Oh, if we could all be so zen all the time. You know, I got a lot of pushback from the Takeaway producers for saying I was just a 7.1 earlier. Hey, I think if you're not losing 1.5 points for righteous indignation and anger right off the top, I don't even want to know you. You know what I mean? 8778 My Take is the number. You can always head to the Takeaways Facebook page. And a reminder to join me tomorrow on Reddit from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern for an Ask Me Anything session. I'll look forward to chatting with you there. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Do be happy. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.